This is the Antisocial Podcast, episode 184. That's 184, folks, with astronaut candidate and jack of all trades, Josh Richards. But before we kick into this episode, my name is Andy Dowling, and as well as hosting this show, I also play bass in the Australian metal band Lord. And if you love a bit of metal, a bit of old school metal, some, guitar solos and sing-alongs and a bit of cheese and some double bass drums and I'm describing this so well. Just go over to lord.net.au. Go and check it all out. We've got all of our video clips up there. I don't know how many video clips we've done over the years. Maybe, I don't know, 8 or 9 or 10. I don't know. Anyway, there's heaps over there. Our whole back catalog's there. You can stream it. The Spotify links, etc. There's heaps of stuff. Go and check it all out. lord.net.au. We've got a brand new album coming out very soon called Fallen Idols. And track one, called United, Welcome Back, is available now. It's the first single and track one off the brand new album. And folks, we aren't doing intros for the new album. There's no intro. So anybody that's been listening to the band for the past 15, 20, 30 years, we love a good intro at the start of a studio album. And this year, or this album, we've decided, nah, fuck it off. So it is straight in. We're not mucking around. First track off the album, and off we go. So you can get a taste of what this album's going to be all about by going to lord.net.au/united, which has got the track listing for the Australian version of the new album, plus the video clip for United, and you can get a t-shirt as well. Go and grab a United t-shirt. Why not? So go and check all that out. If you love the music and you haven't heard it before, go and shoot me a message and let me know, because I'd love to hear from you. And if you didn't like it, shoot me a message anyway and just tell me that it was shit. I don't know. Whatever. Just do it. In addition to playing in a metal band, I also host the Self-Starter Podcast. And guess what, folks? Season 2 is out now. As of the 3rd of June, 5 a.m. Monday morning, and every fortnight at that time, there will be a new episode of Season 2 out of Self-Starter. So Self-Starter is all about small business, self-employment, and freelancing. So if you want to dig into the self-employment world a little bit more, you can go to selfstarter.com.au and go and check all of that out. The first episode, which is actually episode 30, but the first episode of Season 2. I was actually trying to work out whether I should do Season 2, Episode 1, but I figured that whether I do episode 1 or episode 30, there's going to be people with OCD that are going to complain either way. So I figured I'd lean in the direction of my OCD preferences and do episode 30 of season. And it doesn't even make sense when I verbalize it. Anyway, it's episode 30. It's the start of season 2. It's out now. Go and check out that episode. It's with Chris Pachenko of Vanishing Point fame, but he has his business called Speed Metal Scrap. It's a great conversation. I learned a lot more about Chris that I didn't know. And in true Self-Starter format, I have my key takeaways and lots of insights about the chat with Chris. So go and check all that out, selfstarter.com.au, and you can search for Self-Starter in your preferred podcast player. Okay. It's the shout-out section. Every week, I thank somebody that supports me and the podcast. And it can be, and it can be, and a man, it can be in a range of different ways. Such as messages of encouragement, a guest recommendation. I get heaps of great ones, and that really helps me. It could be leaving a review somewhere on the internet or in real life, whatever it is. It could be buying a bit of merchandise, a t-shirt, a patch, or a USB pass, etc., etc., etc. Whatever it is, it doesn't matter. It helps me, keeps this whole thing moving, and just it means a lot. So thank you so much to everybody that supports me. You can hear that I'm struggling through this, folks. Sorry. So this week's shout out, I do thank one person each week, and it is for Bridget Carmody. Now, I've got no freaking idea where Bridget's from, because the reason why I'm giving a shout out to Bridget is that she gave me a beer shout via the PayPal button over at andysocial.net. And there is no information whatsoever to state where Bridget's from. I've tried to look her up online. No idea. But Bridget gave me a beer shout, and all it said in the beer shout was, cheers. So thank you very much. I appreciate it. It is going to go to exactly what it says. And it does support the podcast, of course, because, you know, the more money that you guys give me to buy beer means less of my personal money to go to beer and instead goes back into the podcast. A very roundabout way of supporting the podcast and my love of alcohol. Horrible, I know. But Bridget, when you do hear this, shoot me a message via whatever the hell. You can shoot me an email or whatever and tell me where the hell in the world you are, and I will shoot you out some stuff that I've got lying around the house in the mail, because we all love getting something in the mail, and it's just my little way of saying thank you. So thanks, Bridget. Appreciate the beer shout. Cheers. Speaking of cheers, folks, you can go over to andysocial.net/buy stuff. And that was a bit of a slur. You can go and check out all of the things that I have for sale. It could be stuff such as the band. You can go to the Lord online store over at Bandcamp, or the Dominus Records online store on Bandcamp as well. You can also check out my eBay and Discog stores. The eBay store has an eclectic array of items that Jess and I are selling. Lots of personal stuff, clothing, music memorabilia, lots of odds and ends, unwanted gifts, sorry folks, and lots of random stuff. So you can go over and check that out. And Discogs has over 1,500 odd music items, cassettes, vinyl, CDs, DVDs, ranging from metal to rock to punk to jazz to blues to pop, etc. There's heaps and heaps of stuff over there. So if you go to andysocial.net/buy stuff, you'll be able to have a sticky beak and see what I have. If you can't get through to these pages, then shoot me a DM and I will help you find them, so you can have a sticky beak. I've had a couple of messages from people. A few people to say thank you to. Leah from Wilberforce in New South Wales. Is that a freaking place? Anyway, Andrew from Shelbyville in Kentucky, I believe, in the US of A. Aladdin from Gainesville in Vermont, I think. VA. What's VA? Vermont. How the hell do I know most of these states in the US just by their letters? Like, I've got no idea. Like, I've never lived there. I've been there a few times, but I seem to know. Anyway, whatever. In the US, thank you. David from Bloomington in Indiana, USA, a few USA folks. And Lee from Inverleigh in Victoria. Lee is a big supporter of my Discogs page. Thanks, Lee. Appreciate it. Thanks, everyone that has been buying stuff from all of my different pages. It means a hell of a lot to me. And if you buy something from any of these places and you add a little message in with your order saying that you heard me crapping on in these intros, then I will add something extra, little extra goodies in with your order as well. Just my little way of saying thank you and to know that people listen to me crapping on, because, you know, I'd probably fast forward. Anyway, thank you so much, folks. Really appreciate it. andysocial.net/buy stuff. Episode 184 of the podcast is with Josh Richards. Josh is a physicist, an explosives engineer, a soldier, a comedian, and an astronaut candidate. Josh is most known for being part of the Mars One project, which started off with 200,000 applications and has boiled down to a shortlist of 100 remaining people, which Josh is a part of. The project is set to send a number of people to Mars on a one-way ticket, never to return. This has been an ongoing project for the past several years, and Josh is sitting and waiting for the next stage to roll around in the hope that he becomes one of those final people that will shoot off, hopefully sometime between 2029 and 2031. I caught up with Josh at the Novotel in Sydney just prior to him going to Channel 7 Studios to do Andrew Denton's new show, Andrew Denton's Interview. Wouldn't mind getting that guy on the podcast. And we talked about the whole project, a lot of the psychological challenges around it. We spoke about his book that he released a couple of years ago called Becoming Martian, the current book that he's writing, which will be set to be released at some stage in the future, and a lot of other things that have been happening in his world, his comedy, his shows, this weird mixed bag of skills that he's been able to accumulate and develop over his years, and his time in the army as well. Lots of cool stuff. You can check out Josh by going to joshrichards.space. That's an awesome URL, by the way. Or you can go and check him out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. He's also got a YouTube channel, and I will dump everything in the show notes over at andysocial.net. But for now, please enjoy this amazing conversation with Josh Richards. Interesting place to meet up. We were actually going to do a Skype or a phone call. And you sent me an email earlier in the week
saying I was randomly turning up and sitting. And yeah. Now we're sitting next to the kitchen, apparently.
So we're going to have, I think everyone listening in now, we're going to possibly have a few interruptions, a little bit of noise in the background, but it adds to the vibe of the conversation.
On natural.
That's right. Yeah, I don't want a dead room with no other noise. It'll be too bland and too stale. Big night ahead for you?
Sort of, I guess. I don't get too flustered about interviews, but yeah, I'm speaking to Andrew Denton tonight as part of a big TV series interview thing, which will be fun, I guess.
Be awesome.
Yeah.
And when you gave me a couple of options, because you thought I might catch up this afternoon or tomorrow morning, I thought, no, I'm going to get in before Denton.
once he's not wasted from being grilled on stage.
Well, I think if you're going to get interviewed by anyone, especially in this country, it's Andrew Denton. I mean, he's the person. So it's
I have to say, I'm not interviews in an interview. Talk about whatever. People ask me questions, and I answer them honestly. It doesn't really matter. But it is a bit of an honour to be invited on. I'm excited about meeting him, and we'll just have a chat. We're having a chat.
Absolutely. I can't wait to see it. And by the time this comes out, the episode with Denton would no doubt already be out anyway.
I hope so. Otherwise, this will be awkward.
Yeah. Anyway, people can go and check that out. So I was writing notes, and usually I'd just jot down a bunch of stuff, things just to trigger sort of my head as I'm sort of having this conversation. And I just went down this rabbit hole, and I'm like, okay, this guy's going to go to Mars, and we'll get into all that sort of stuff. But I'm like, he does this, he does that, he's involved in this, he's doing stand-up comedy, he's writing, he's doing all this, he's doing Science Week and all that sort of stuff. And I'm just trying to think, what's the strategy here?
There's no strategy. There is zero strategy.
Because, I mean, you sort of look at it, and I'll get you to sort of fill in the gaps as far as the context behind the Mars One project, because when I looked at it, I thought, are you deliberately trying to do as many different random things as possible to basically up your stakes as far as being this versatile jack of all trades, this mastermind of everything? So they're looking at you going, we need this guy
It's probably
mission.
More the other way. I have joked about it being career ADD.
Yeah.
Since I discovered Mars One 7 years ago now, 6.5, 7 years ago now, this is the first time I've gone, cool, I know what I'm working at. Whereas in the past, and you alluded to some of it before, a lot of the other stuff that I've done previously has been, I'm going to give this a go. I think this is what I care about. And then I start doing it and I get jaded with it. And then I go, well, I feel trapped by this. Where else am I going to go? And I go and do something else. And that's why, jumping from 6 years in the military to mining to stand-up comedy to the fine arts, just bouncing around, really lost. If I'm honest, it was me being lost and not having any real sense of direction. And Mars One coming along saying, if you want to go to Mars One way, we'll give you the opportunity. I was like, yes, this is what I care about.
Now, okay, so did you literally jump at that opportunity where you go, was it just a no-brainer, or was it something that you sort of went, that's a bit of a novelty, I'm going to have to sit and think about it a little bit?
No, it was a no-brainer. I had just finished my fourth year up at the Edinburgh Fringe. Yeah. I just finished a comedy show doing, basically dressing up as a giant angry koala and screaming at people for 45 minutes. And what a lot of folks don't realise about that show is it was therapy. It was me sharing stories from the military, wearing a mask that wasn't me. It was this crazy koala character, and the crazy koala character could share stuff. I had done that because I had wanted to write a comedy show about sending people one way to Mars. I'd started writing it in 2011 and realised there was all this stuff, all this trauma from the military that I hadn't dealt with. So I did the koala show, and as soon as Edinburgh Fringe was done, I was like, right, September 2012, I am going to start writing this Mars show that I've been thinking about since I read a paper in 2006 by Paul Davies saying the first people going to Mars would probably have to go one way. And ever since then, my thoughts have been, well, why would you want to come back? Let's do it. And I started researching the comedy show in, like I said, September 2012. And literally typed Mars One Way into Google, and Mars One had made their first public announcement
incredible.
A week before. So
that's crazy, because you'd think that obviously you'd see the project and that would inspire you to then start digging into how you could sort of put that into your comedy and your stand-up stuff.
No, I was already on the show. I'd been discussing 2 weeks before with a mate of mine, Cameron Davis, an amazing improviser in Edinburgh, and we sat down for an hour over coffee and talked about what this Mars show would look like, and talking about you could, simulate the time delay in the show with such and such, and hashed out all these things. And 2 weeks later, I sat down to go, right, I'm going to start looking for the details, and they'd made their announcement in the meantime. So the moment I found it, it was a case of, well, I'm not just going to write a show about this. I'm going to sign up for it. And they're looking for a crew of four. I'm going to make the show about trying to find the other three people that will come with me. Like, it was an instant thing.
But were you more driven by the novelty of the fact that you had this great idea in your head creatively and it sort of aligned, and then it was after the fact, after you sort of gone, I'm going to do this, that you thought, oh, well, there's a reality to this. Like, it's
no,
a real thing.
I think you're giving me way too much creative credit there. The show was angry.
Yeah.
Like I said, the show before it, Keith looks back in anger with a koala.
I saw some clips of that. It's pretty intense.
It's horrifying. But very, very broken human being, 2012. Yeah. Yeah. And I was finding a way of dealing with it. And the next show, the show about Mars, was going to be angry too. It was going to be this frustrated rage that we as a species haven't tried to do something more extraordinary. That young men growing up are often drawn to things like the military rather than having the opportunity to work in the space industry. And I pinpointed a moment when I was a kid that I realised where I switched from loving space to wanting to be in the military. And it was being told that I couldn't go to space because I was Australian. And like that was what it basically boiled down to. You can't join NASA because NASA only has US citizens working for it. And the only people going to space are the Russians and the Americans. So you can't go to space. So there was this very clear moment when I was seven of being told, you can't go to space. And so I turned from that to what my dad was doing, and dad as a role model, and went and joined the army. So the show was originally going to be this really frustrated thing of, why do we get so fixated on which patch of dirt we're born on? And why aren't we doing extraordinary things as a species? And it was angry. The show was angry. And Mars One came along and that flipped in a heartbeat. It stopped being angry and it started being, this is the thing that I'm doing. It's important. Who wants to come with me?
There'd be an element of, like, fulfillment that would be attached to it, because you've got this... You've got this sort of... This is the worst, not the worst, but it's a silly way of putting it. You've got this light at the end of the tunnel, in a way, which is Mars.
Yeah.
But you've got something that you're working towards now, and there's this pathway. Whereas, I guess, as you said before, you've dabbled in a whole bunch of different things. You've tried to fill in some gaps and try and stimulate yourself with interests along the way, and then things have aligned and now starting to make a lot more sense. But I guess going into the Mars One thing, from what I read, and I'll definitely be honest, I didn't read a lot, but from what I could see, it started off with, there's a couple hundred thousand applications that were put in.
So, 202,586 people started the application process. Yeah. And that's not applications submitted. That's the number of people that started that process.
Right, and then got cold feet through that.
And, it was a huge application. It took me 3 days.
Oh,
like,
really?
There was multiple 5,000-word essays in there. Like, what you see publicly is a tiny sliver of what we did. So the application process itself was a test.
Yeah.
If you start being asked difficult questions like, will you give up your friends and family to go to Mars? Mm. Will you do it? It forces people to ask questions that they probably haven't asked previously.
Mm.
And that's why we had this huge number of people go, yeah, I want to go to Mars. And then when they actually start doing the application, they go, oh, wait, what am I actually signing up for? There's that initial enthusiasm, and then the reality starts to sink in. So there was only, I think it's about 12 or 14,000 people who actually finished the application.
Right.
And of those, that group was cut very quickly down to 1,058 that they considered serious applicants.
Mm.
So that was way back, that was the end of 2013. Following on from that, they sent us off for an aviation medical, the same thing a commercial pilot does, and that screened out about 350 people, so we're down to 705. They left us in the dark for about 9 months, didn't tell us anything, wouldn't answer emails, wouldn't do anything.
Oh, wow.
And another 45 people decided, no, not for me, and that was a test as well.
Mm.
So 660 went to interview, and the interview only lasted, for me, my interview only lasted 7 minutes. I got asked 6 questions, and they were...
And where did you go for that interview? Was it...
So it was all done via Skype. So we've got candidates
globally. Yeah.
So Dr. Norbert Kraft was the medical interviewer. He did all 660 interviews over 2 months, and he's based in San Jose, and basically we were given times that we'd need to make ourselves available, and it was not, and it was an intense but very short interview. And the questions they asked, he asked, very focused on language. It wasn't... you needed to know details. You needed to know engineering, things like how much water are you going to have? Like, where's that water going to come from? That kind of basic stuff.
Yep.
But one of the questions was, describe a time that you worked in a team.
Okay.
And if you are describing a time that you worked in a team by saying, I did this and I directed people and I led this and I saw there was a problem here, so I told someone to go and sort that out, blah, blah, blah. That's not you working in a team.
No, no.
That's you telling other people what to do. So they were looking for we. We did this. We solved this. One small group went off and dealt with this, blah, blah, blah. We rather than I. And it's little things like that that reflect your psychology and where your focus is that helps identify the right kind of people that they need.
So after that, because I know that on the website it said it's in round three at the moment.
Yep.
And there's 100 people.
Yes.
50 men, 50 women.
Yep.
How long have you been in round three status?
A long time. It is immensely frustrating. It's not anything the candidates can do. It's not actually anything even the CEO or the Mars One as an organisation can do. They have run into funding issues. They've been up against funding issues from the start. And at the moment, we're in this kind of holding pattern where we got a listing on the Frankfurt Stock Exchange. It was a bit of a poison chalice. And while it's still being resolved at the moment, we're dealing with all the bureaucracy. I'm not a finance guy. I don't get stock exchange. I don't understand. Alan Kohler comes on the TV on ABC News and I walk out of the room. I can't do it. But yeah, we've been in this holding pattern for a while and it all comes back to money.
Wow.
So that's been since February 2015.
One thing that I did see was the due date or the date that they were aiming for. And I think that's changed.
It's changed a few times.
Yeah. What's it currently standing at? It'll change again.
We're looking at launching 2031.
Okay.
That's not an engineering date. There's a couple of factors in it. You can only launch every 26 months when the planets line up. So there's a literal physical element to that.
Yeah.
In terms of getting the technology and building the equipment, all that sort of stuff, it would not take us, if we started today, it would not take till 2031 to do that.
Yeah.
SpaceX, there's every possibility that SpaceX will have Mars capability by 2026, 2027. And we would quite happily buy seats from them if that opportunity was there. 2031 comes back to investment.
Yeah.
Investors believe that 2031 is reasonable. They don't believe that 2027 is believable. And so Mars One originally was talking about, I think when they first started, they were talking about 2024. And I was like, that's ludicrous. They said 2027, and I still think 2027's achievable.
Mm.
2029 is the loop after that, and that's highly achievable. 2031 is the one that most of the folks who are investing believe is possible, and that's why we've said 2031.
And what's the final number of people that they're going to dwindle it down to? So you're at 100 now.
This is 100 of us. The group will get cut to about 40 over 5 days, 5 days of group testing. The 40 that remain from that very quickly, straight afterwards, they get taken camping for 10, 11 days. And if you want to learn who you want to live with, go camping. At the end of that, they're aiming to have between 12 to 24 people who... There's also a four-hour interview in there as well, just to placate people who need to have a psych interview. 12 to 24 that come out of that process, and those folks basically form an astronaut corps, the same way that NASA has a corps of astronauts, ESA does as well. And those folks train, and they start testing who works well with who. So-and-so fits well with so-and-so, but when this person is introduced, the dynamic breaks down. And so they start seeing who works well together, start putting people in habitats and seeing how they respond long-term, and you start to see some of the uglier personality traits start to come out after a few weeks, and so you can start to screen some of those people out. As people drop out, people get removed or they take themselves out, they'll reopen for applications to top that pool up.
Wow.
And the goal is about 4 or 5 years before a launch date, you'll have 12 people, so three crews of four, and all of them would be exceptional. They'd all be the right kind of people to go. Any one of those teams could go, and you won't find out which of those teams is actually going until after they've gone. Because if they climb into the capsule and decide at the last minute they can't do it, you have to remove the entire crew and replace them with one of the two backups, but you don't want to tell the backups that they're backups. So you won't know, the public won't know, and the people who are actually doing it won't know that they're going to be the first crew until they're literally climbing into the capsule.
It's like next, it's psychologically, it's like next, it's next level. I read, and you've probably read the book, what's his name, Chris Hadfield? The
Astronaut's Guide to...
That's it. And I think he talks about similar scenarios of what they have to sort of go through mentally to sort of prep themselves for these sort of situations. So I kind of have heard some of these things mentioned before. But it's, because it's not far off, but it is kind of far off. It's still several years away and there's a lot of unknowns there. But, I mean, what do you do when you don't know exactly when that next update's going to be? Like, what sort of things do you do to prepare yourself and to think, okay, how do I best place myself so I'm going to be in the... I have the best odds of being able to get through to that next round?
So my focus is less on being in that next round. That would be great. Yeah. I'd love that. The biggest thing for me is I want this to happen.
Mm.
Even before any of Mars One, I was upset that we as a species weren't living on other planets. And so I actually personally don't care if I go or not. The best way that I can advocate for putting humans on another planet is to try and be one of the people that does it. And so I spend a lot of time looking at what I would do if I got selected.
Mm.
If we got told, if I woke up tomorrow morning to an email from Mars One saying selection is going ahead in October.
Mm.
I'd be turning around and going, okay, well, what can I do between now and October to make the most of the time that I've got? Because after that, I may not have the same amount of time available to do the things that I want to do. Not just how do I get selected, but also if I am selected, I'm shortlisted, I then go into intensive training. Like, there's no time to go and sail a boat around the world for 4 months, or there's no time to go and climb Everest or do or any of these other things because I'm training for a one-way mission to Mars. So I kind of have to turn around and go, what can I do today? What's the thing that I care about today? And the book that I'm writing at the moment, writing has always been a one way of processing things for me. I spend a lot of time writing, and the book that I'm writing now is, what would you do? Asking the audience or asking the reader, what would you do if you had 10 years left on Earth? And then me answering that question for myself and saying, these are the things that I would do. And these are actually, this is how I'm going about it. This is how I'm doing it right now.
Because, I mean, you hear all those cliches that everybody says, you know, live your day like it's your last, and those bucket list sort of things. But we sort of, I think we all just fall into the everyday grind of it all, and we sort of lose track of it. And it's only really when there's an unexpected moment or a tragedy or something like that that people suddenly are awakened and go, oh, wow, I've got to actually do something about my life. So your circumstances are so unique in a way, but it feeds back into this thing that people are trying to find themselves all the time by trying to make the most out of their lives.
What?
But you've put yourself in a position where you're so hyper aware of it.
Yeah. When I get it from two angles. I get that of I have a potential set date where I'm not on this planet anymore. And that's not dying or whatever, but it's like September 2031, there's every possibility, or sooner, but like that could be a reality. On the other perspective, I never thought I'd make 30. The stuff that I did with the military was pretty pointy, pretty like high mortality rate type stuff. And so, especially in my early mid-20s, I was utterly convinced I'd never make it to 30.
Did you serve overseas?
So I never spent time... I spent time with the British Commandos, but I never deployed, which I'm immensely grateful for.
Absolutely.
But even so, like, the Royal Marines lose one or two recruits a year. Mm. Like, I had friends fall off ropes and break backs. Ugh. I nearly died of Lyme's disease while I was there. Like, the list is long. Yeah. And you, that's just part of what you're doing.
Yeah.
It's just part of the job. It's not that you expect it, but you certainly don't. You certainly don't turn around and go, "Oh, I'm going to live till I'm 55 or 60 or whatever, or 80." It's like, no, no, I'll probably do a few tours and I'll probably catch it at some point, but I'm going to make the most of it while I'm doing that, because I feel like what I'm doing has meaning.
Yeah.
And the reason why I left the military was because I realized that I didn't feel like I was making the world safer. Mm. I didn't think I was making the place better.
Yeah.
And so it became a fairly easy decision, just be like, no, I'm not going to risk my life. I'm also not going to do something that is hurting people.
Mm.
So, no, I'm lucky, I suppose, in that I potentially have this thing that might happen in 10, 12 years' time. I also am immensely grateful that I'm here in the first place, because there's been no shortage of close calls where if something had gone slightly differently, I wouldn't be chatting to you now.
Absolutely.
So.
Yeah, that's right. Sitting in this thoroughfare at the hotel.
Yeah, yeah.
It's I think the really interesting thing that I sort of got just keeping a close eye on you over the last few months as we've been trying to work this chat out, is it sort of puts things in perspective for me. So it's like anything, you listen to an interview or you watch somebody or see their story or you're watching a movie or something like that, and you start to draw parallels and you compare yourself to them and where you fit into your world versus theirs. And I think when I see all the things that you have been doing and putting yourself into these situations where there's big commitments, massive commitments.
Yeah.
And I sort of start thinking in my own life and going, well, what would I do in those situations? And then you start to then think about, what do I take for granted at this point in time in my life? And what should I be doing that I'm actually not? Like, what am I procrastinating over? Oh, I should really, like, get in the car and go and do this podcast or whatever it might be. And I think there's no doubt there's a lot of value that you get personally out of everything that you're doing now. And there's that fulfillment and it's ticking a lot of boxes for you in your life. But I think just going back to what you said as far as those reasons for leaving the military, I think now you're in a position where not only have you got this bigger goal to be able to advance, you know, the human progress, of being able to leave the planet and go somewhere else and see what we can achieve, but I think also you're showing people what the possibilities are.
And I would say that's actually more important than my personal fulfillment. Like I said, I'm very grateful to still be here after 30. I feel like the things that I did while I was still with the military cleared any debt that I may have felt. Like, I did enough good for the folks around me that I don't feel like I owe anyone anything. Which means I can now do whatever the hell I want. And I'm in an awesome position where, especially with kids, especially being able to go and visit schools and talk to people about all of this sort of stuff, and hopefully impact some of them so that rather than going down the path that I did, tell them, hey, you can work in space. You can do all this sort of stuff. I love speaking to 7-year-olds. I love talking to year twos in particular, because it's like that was the age where someone told me I couldn't do this, and now I get to tell all of them, you absolutely can, and you don't have to do it the stupid way that I'm doing it, but you have the opportunity to be involved with this. And I hope they appreciate that. It doesn't matter, because that's all I can do. All I can do is say, this is what I'm doing, and kind of be an example. It's the reason really I signed up was, it's not about being first. I don't care about being first. I care about humanity having a permanent human presence on another planet that kids can watch on the 6 o'clock news and go, that's what I want to do when I grow up, and whoever's there next to him can say, you can. It didn't matter where he came from. He's a bloody military dropout and he barely scraped through uni and a whole bunch of different things, but he did that because that's what was important to him.
Yeah.
So that's the flow-on effect to me is way more important than me succeeding. That's why I say it doesn't matter if I go or I don't go. It matters that someone goes, because the impact that's going to have to our species is extraordinary.
Absolutely. You was it last year you put out your book, Becoming Martian?
National Science Week 2017. Yeah.
2017. So, okay. Yeah. All right. Oh, that's right. We're in 2019 now.
That's right. I forget too.
How did that go? As far as, you know, getting a reaction, and I've seen, like, you know, you go on the Mars One website, and even on yours, and there's a long list of media that you've done, and
yeah.
you've had some good exposure. But what sort of impact has the book had so far?
The book for me was really something I had to do.
Yeah.
When I first found Mars One, Cameron Davies, the guy that I've been thinking about Cameron a bit over the last few months, actually, just because there's a lot of parallels coming back. Cameron had written a book. Rather than doing a comedy show.
Okay.
So comedians, you get on the circuit, you get on the loop of, like, you write a show and then you've got to start writing next year's show and all this sort of stuff. Cameron had broken that by saying he wasn't going to write a show. He wrote a book and then he started doing book readings. And that planted a seed back in 2012 of, like, I don't actually like comedy that much. I don't like, I don't mind talking to people and standing on stage, but I much prefer to get my thoughts out on paper. I always have. So why aren't I writing books? And Becoming Martian for 2017 was my first trial with that, my first case of, like, I have to get this out. I broke the book down into three parts, talking about how our bodies, our minds, and our culture will change by colonizing Mars. And there was no attempt to put me in it. My personality creeps through the jokes, but it was very focused on these are the impacts. This is what's going to happen to the people who actually go. It's bad for their bodies. It's bad for their minds, but the cultural impact is huge. And so I kind of, writing that was an amazing experience. Publishing it and promoting it and all that sort of stuff, that's great. But for me, it was way more important to just write it. If I'd written the book and through some quirk it couldn't be published, I still would have been okay with that, because it clarified everything for me. And it's now a go-to. If people turn around to me and say, talk to me about what happens to your bones and your body, I'm like, go and read the book, because there's four pages on that.
Well,
like,
I do have a couple of questions about that kind of stuff, because when I was driving here, I was on the phone to my wife and I had mentioned you.
Sure.
But look, sometimes I talk too much and she zones out and vice versa.
Yeah, yep.
But then she went, hang on, whoa. He's going to Mars. Yeah, yeah. But he's not coming back. Yeah, yeah. And then the questions came. As you would have got over the last several years. So we'll get to that in a moment, because I've got a few things in my head that I'll have to, and Jess will kick me if I don't ask. But so for you to be able to go through that process of getting it on paper, formalising it, it's a bit of a reference guide for people. And if people want to know a little bit more about... Probably not so much you personally, but what you're aiming towards and what that experience potentially is going to be like, that's the starting point.
It's a reference point. It's something that it answers probably 95% of the questions that I get on the details.
Yeah.
On the, not necessarily specific to Mars One. Mm. It's actually more broadly about Mars itself.
Yeah.
There's some funny stories in there. There's all sorts of bits and pieces in there to try and convey the science and the impact of all this sort of stuff. And the book that I'm working on now, after I did Becoming Martian as a comedy show, I toured it in 2014.
Yeah.
It felt very dry. It felt very like it didn't have any of me in it. Mm-hmm. And the book is better, but the book still is very... dry is the wrong word, but it's depersonalized. I've deliberately removed myself from it to talk about all the funny.
A little bit clinical in a way?
It's a little bit, but it's still funny. Yeah. Still designed to be very funny.
Mm-hmm.
But there's none of my personal story in it.
Yeah.
And the thing that everyone asked after the show was done and when the book was published was, what about you?
Mm.
They wanted to know how it's impacted my relationships, how it's impacted how I live my life. They want to know that very human story, not just the science of what's going to happen to your body and culture and blah, blah, blah. So the show that I did in 2016, Cosmic Nomad, I'm now writing the book version of that which flips the other way and gets uncomfortably vulnerable to talk about all the impacts that have happened to me personally, my personal experience.
And I think that's what's going to be incredibly relatable to people, because if you're sort of going through that sort of factual approach of explaining what may happen and it's not personalized for you, people will sort of look at that and still be disconnected from them. There'd be a detachment where they might not be able to really personalize themselves or put themselves in that situation. It's like, oh, this is interesting, it's fascinating. But then to be able to hear your thoughts of how you could be impacted by it and what you're going through at the moment and the way that you're viewing everything and your perspective, I mean, then people are going to make it really relatable to them.
I don't want to be too critical of Becoming Martian, because I am very proud of that book.
Yeah.
But in many ways, it was a data dump for me. It was a case of, like, this is everything that I've learnt over the last 5 or 6 years about Mars.
Yeah.
And these are the questions that I get asked consistently about Mars. And I'm going to put all of that into one book that people can read, they can laugh, they can enjoy it and all that sort of stuff. And I'll tackle the far more challenging personal stuff in something separate, rather than trying to educate people about space and tell my story at the same time. I split the two as comedy shows, and so I've split the two as books as well. And if people want to know what happens to your bones on Mars, read Becoming Martian. Mm. If they want to know how I feel about it or how I'm dealing with that prospect while I'm still here on Earth, then the next book is going to be about that.
Yeah. It's such an amazing scenario and it's a hard thing to wrap your head around, because even as I started thinking about it, and it's like, you know, we've got astronauts, there have been space programs, there are space programs, so the concept of people leaving the planet to explore exists, and so it's in our minds to a degree. And this is the next step. And it's almost like, as you said before, you're not dying.
No.
Like, you still exist, but you're not coming back. And that's...
when it challenges...
it's such a big thing to... It's a challenge. It's a challenge mentally.
The thing that... I mean, we think about this... Humans are funny in that we are only good at remembering the last generation.
Mm.
You go back a couple of generations, and the way that people lived a few generations ago seems immensely foreign.
Mm.
The Irish, in particular, around the end of the 1800s, would have living wakes. So people going and moving across to the US, moving to Boston, the family in Ireland would hold a living wake for them before they left, as if they were dying, on the principle that they were never going to see them again.
That's right.
And so they needed to have that sort of that tradition, that process. So that's a little over 100 years ago. In terms of humanity, that's not particularly long, but we forget about that. We get very comfortable of how our life and our society works now, and we forget that not that long ago, people went on huge expeditions to Antarctica and did it on the expectation that maybe they didn't come back, that they would move to a whole other place, and they knew they were never coming back. We're so lucky now to be able to... I've flown over from Perth today. Yeah. I'm here tonight. I'm flying back to Perth tomorrow. On Wednesday, I fly from Perth back to Melbourne. Like 100, 120 years ago.
No way.
That's months each way. Like,
that's right. You probably would have settled down here for a while and worked your life out, and then it could have extended longer as well.
We adapt so quickly. I love reminding people the first iPhone came out in 2007, and look at the way how did you survive before an iPhone?
Yeah.
And yet, if you took an iPhone off someone and they found themselves abandoned in the wilderness, they'd probably adapt to that. They would adapt very quickly as well. So we're a very adaptive species, but I think we have a limited perspective and we forget just what we're capable of at times.
I've got a lot to think about on that drive home.
Super
later on.
Deep.
Oh, I know. But I mean, look, you've had, I mean, as you said, you're going through this process now of writing this follow-up, this book that's going to be more personal. So you've had a lot of time to think about this stuff.
When I had to write the show for 2016, the first, so almost all of it's an interesting show. It was catalyzed by a breakup, the show couldn't be done. I started writing it in early 2015, but I couldn't actually finish writing the show until we broke up. And then 2016 was this huge, like, this race around the world, my last big comedy tour globally for 10 months or whatever it was. So there was a lot of time to think about all this sort of stuff in the lead up to that show. There was more time to think about it while I was touring. And then realistically, I haven't changed gears very much in the last 3 years. So I'm excited about it. People who might have seen the show back in 2016, the book's going to have a similar tone, but at the same time, it's going to be so much more detailed and so much better thought out than the ramblings of a ginger maniac on stage back in 2016. So,
I mean, like anybody, you know, a few months later, a lot of things can change.
Yeah.
A few years later, a lot of things can change. So even the way that you might have looked at the situation several years ago might be a little bit different now,
yeah,
and slightly different colour to it. So, yeah, that'll be quite interesting, because I think that's what people are going to really fixate on, is that how would I mentally be able to handle this? How would I go through these things? What sort of thoughts am I going to have? And sort of think about those bigger questions in life and really put things into perspective.
It's funny, as you get older, I look back now over the 6.5-7 years I've been involved with this, and the urgency, the desperation to do certain things, and got to do this and got to sort this out and all that sort of stuff, all of that has dialed right back. As I've gotten older, as I've gotten into my early 30s, a lot of that urgency has started to come away, with an understanding that a lot of things will shake out the way that they need to. Rather than me forcing it to go a certain way, they'll shake out the way that they need to. And that's been very clear with the book. Even in the last few years, the book, the show that for 2016, Cosmic Nomad, I mentioned the relationship. I was writing that show as a way of getting over the relationship, and I listen back to the audio from it now and I'm like, dude, you are still hurting a whole lot. And I was subconsciously trying to retain that in the book version, and it's only been it has taken a lot longer than I probably expected. I was writing the show in 2016, like, yep, dealt with, done. I'm moving on, I'm living life. And it's like, I look back at it now, I'm like, no, you were so still burnt, still really badly hurt. And I'm now in a position where it's like, if I can look back at that and go, yes, you were still hurt, and I can do that objectively now I'm like, cool. Now I'm in a position to actually write the book, to actually pour things out properly. Because if I'd forced the book out a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, it wouldn't have had the same impact that I'm certain it's going to have now.
Well, it's kind of like writing a draft, you know, writing several drafts and going back and critiquing it and seeing where you can tighten things up, or maybe, you know, polishing up some of the things. Because a lot of it, I guess, it's like anything. It's like when you sort of referred to fairly or unfairly with your first book,
you know,
it's a brain dump. It was a data dump of just getting everything out. So for you, you know, getting out there and speaking to people, that was almost your first draft of getting out there and
absolutely
trying to work through the content.
What I recognised out of that is that, for me at least, performing and writing are two, even though I've linked them a lot, they're actually two very different formats for me. And I've had a lot of trouble going back to Cameron Davis back in 2012. Cameron wrote the book and then started doing readings at the Edinburgh Fringe. I have been talking about doing it that way for a very long time, and I've always done it the other way. I've written the show because it's like, oh, I can write a show. I could do a 45-50 minute show, and then I'll turn it into a book. And what I've started to recognize, what I have finally recognized, is Cosmic Nomad's going to be the last one that I've performed and then turned into a book, because I really need to focus on write the book, and then if there's an opportunity to talk about it, if then there's an opportunity to tour it and read it and all that stuff, that's great. But the really genuine Josh, the really genuine version of my voice, comes through writing without the expectation that an audience is going to hear it on stage. So it needs to be the book first and then come out in other formats on stage. But that's taken a long time to figure out. Oh,
well, it's like anything, though. I mean, a lot of people that I've had on the podcast, I mean, I'm in my mid-30s now, and I've got a lot of friends and peers that are musicians, and they've gone through the late 20s into the 30s transition where they had this crisis where it's like, oh, my God, what am I doing with my life? Yeah. Have I achieved anything yet? Oh, I haven't got started. I'm comparing myself to somebody else out there that I've got no connection with apart from an age. You know, I think you kind of, I mean, and what you've done is pretty incredible, and I think, and you're gonna have your own perspective of that.
But yeah,
I think you've had to go through a lot of this to get to where you are now. You've had to try lots of different things.
I still compare, and that's one thing that shifting away from stand up. I needed to turn around and go, it doesn't matter what. Loved Sam Simmons. Always been a huge fan of Sam Simmons, and still think he's hysterical. And one of the things that I vividly remember doing during Edinburgh Fringe was looking at Sam's Wikipedia entry and thinking, oh, okay, he had his such and such show, big break, he was 35. And, you know, he was figuring this out. So in my head, I'm thinking like, oh, okay, I've still got a few years before I'm at the same point. And it's like, no, just do what you care about.
Yeah,
like, do stuff that you love. Don't give a shit about what, like, how old someone else was when they did such and such.
That's it.
Do the things you care about. And that's the hardest thing, was leaving the military was a tough one. Leaving stand-up, honestly, has been really difficult, and I still slip occasionally. I went back to my old comedy room a couple of weeks ago and I did something stupid in a banana suit. Like, you still slip, and I have recognised now that I need to do stuff that I care about, and I care about writing far more than I do being on stage. And so I need to focus on that. And it doesn't matter, it's not like I'm joining writers groups or comparing myself to writers or anything like that. It's just like,
sure thing,
I want to write. So I'm writing.
have you sort of thought, I mean, it might not be a conscious thing, but have you sort of thought along the way that if you do get to that point where you are jetting off,
yep,
and that's it, you're off for that next the next chapter, are you kind of hoping in the back of your mind that you are able to leave a number of things behind, that so the books and things that you've been doing, as far as,
not at all,
it's not something that's just this is for you, and it's obviously just
I really don't care about legacy.
It's a big thing for a lot of people panic and think that I've got to do something that people can remember. I don't want to be forgotten.
When it's a big segment in the book, it's the upcoming book, and it's a big segment in the show. The last fifth of the show is talking about legacy, and I joke about it, saying like I signed up to be a sperm donor to leave a legacy that no one's ever going to remember. Yeah. Like, I've always hung on to the movie's not great, but the final scene in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Yeah, yeah. Arthur Dent gets asked what if there's anything that Earth could do without, and he basically turns around and goes, me. I'm all for that. I don't care about my legacy. I don't care about any of that sort of stuff whatsoever. What I care about is us as a species doing awesome things, going and living on other planets or living amongst the stars or whatever, and not killing each other because of stupid, like, tiny differences. That is something I care about. So this is way bigger than me or my legacy, and it's actually part of the reason why I'm a good candidate, because it's bigger than friends, it's bigger than family, it's bigger than countries or your hometown or any of that other garbage. It's like, this is something we're doing as a species.
Your motivation's in the right spot. And it's almost it's a selfless sort of approach where you don't have a second agenda there where...
Yeah. I don't know about selfless, purely because people sort of think of that as an altruistic thing. I just don't give a shit. Like, I'm not fussed. I didn't think I would still be here at 33.
Yeah.
So I can be involved with something that makes life hopefully better for people around me, people everywhere. and I guess I'm contributing to the well-being of the species.
Yeah, wow. Okay. drop the mic.
Just drop that at the end.
Yeah. Well, I think, and people can obviously check out all the show notes. I'm going to put everything in there so they can cool. follow you and keep it up to date. I know you've got a Patreon, so you're trying to push that as well. And I know a lot of people that are on that bandwagon. I say that in the nicest way possible because people want to be able to do the things that they love and that they care about. And there's a lot of people out there that want to support.
So I was about to say, the Patreon one's an interesting one in that a lot of folks wanted to support. Mm. I kept getting asked all the time, like, how can we help you do what you do? I'm like, well, if you guys are paying for my writing, that means I can go and do more school visits for free. I can share more stuff. I can focus on this rather than trying to find out how to feed myself. I can focus on this stuff. And so I put a lot of effort into Patreon. I write a lot for it, but it's a twofold thing. It's not just about I make a little bit of money out of it. Not a lot, but I make a little bit of money out of it. What it does do is keeps me disciplined with writing. I'm like, every week you need to be publishing this, you need to be doing this, you need to share such and such. Like,
you're accountable,
and it keeps me accountable. I deliberately didn't set Patreon for per item. I turned around and said per month, and I promised that I would deliver this each month, and if I don't, there's people who are literally expecting this stuff. So it was like, well, what are you doing? Get on with it, write it.
It's a great way of looking at it, because, you know, I know a lot of people that have accounts and do pretty well, and they create some amazing content for people, and no doubt they've thought about this, but I've just never looked at it that way. I just think you're getting people to support you creating content, and obviously they're enjoying it and they're getting something out of it, but the accountability piece of it is it's really powerful.
It's a deliberate... There's literally a choice in Patreon of, do you do it per item or do you do it per month? And for me, when I saw that decision, I'm like, this is 100% going to be an accountability. I've been writing for 12 years, like writing blogs, writing stuff online, and the websites that I've always run, I might write consistently for a couple of months, and then it'll fall silent for six, and then it'll come back again, or it'll be another burst or whatever. With this, it's like every month I'm writing this article, I'm writing this article, I'm sharing this thing, like, and the consistency, the discipline has really come from accountability. I can be fairly disciplined, but at the same time, if I know that there are people expecting something from me on a certain date, I bloody do it.
I like it. I'm definitely going to look at that very differently, because I think there's a lot of value in that. And okay, I won't get down a Patreon rabbit hole, because the cogs are turning in my head. Okay, so before we wrap it up, I'm going to ask you a bunch of questions on behalf of my wife.
For sure.
And these have come through my head, and obviously people can go and read the book. I'm going to have links. So
yep, cool.
There's the ebook, the PDF download, there's the audio book as well, there's a physical book, and there's a couple
there's
of
like
options.
13 copies of the physical book that if people want, I can sign, but like that's going to be it.
We'll get in there.
I am not printing anymore. You can get them from the publisher, but I'm not printing or signing.
There you go
anymore.
Folks, so get in there quick. I'll put the links in there so people can grab a copy. So people can go and check all that stuff out if they want some more detail. But What does happen to your body when you're
in Mars? Horrendous.
Like, what kind of things are to be expected?
So, like, the first 3 days or so, you've got an enormous amount of fluid that's stored in your legs. Mm. Your blood and all that sort of stuff is stored in your legs. And as soon as you take gravity away, all that fluid shifts up into your chest, into your face and all that stuff. So for the first 3 or 4 days or so, all the wrinkles disappear, guys get bigger shoulders, women get bigger busts, like it is looking pretty sexy in space. And then your body goes, nope, and you basically piss it all out.
Wow.
And you shrivel up like Mr. Burns.
Just got that image of him in the shower.
Not good. There's a lot of discussion about bone density and muscle density and all that sort of stuff. What we have seen from the International Space Station over the last few years, the research that's been going on there, you can mitigate all muscle loss and all bone loss with about 15 hours of exercise a week. Now, people sort of go, 15 hours, that's two and a half hours exercise a day. And then you take like a medication for... osteoporosis, cortisol, adrenaline, and that basically stabilizes everything. There's still issues with your eyes. So they talk about interocular pressure. So it's essentially the optic nerve is being... It gets irritated. It gets it flares up and it increases the pressure inside your eyeball and it starts to deform the lens. They don't necessarily know why it happens other than the nerve is being inflamed. And the result is that astronauts start to become short-sighted. Wow. They start to... Long-sighted.
Long-sighted, yeah.
Because the literally the lens and the retina is being shifted. And so, yeah, you start to see... Bob Thirsk is a Canadian astronaut, retired now, but Bob wore glasses occasionally before he went up, was massively affected. Like he was the first one that they really measured properly back in the mid-90s, and it changed by... multiple diopters. Like it was a significant change to his vision, and we've seen it in about 70% of astronauts that go to the space station for more than a few weeks. So that's one of the big ones, is this interocular pressure, and they're trying to finding solutions to it. One potential solution is to have astronauts wear swimming goggles at night. And that pressure around the outside of the eye is actually enough to shift the fluid back and improve it.
But a little bit of a reset kind of...
In a sense. What we really need is we need to have artificial gravity on our space stations. We need to be able to have some sort of setup where, at least while people are sleeping, they're experiencing some kind of gravity, because most of these effects start to emerge when the gravity drops below 10%. Plants can't work out which way's up and down to grow roots unless there's 10% gravity. And we're seeing a lot of the same sort of stuff with our bodies as
well. Incredible.
Which makes it interesting for Mars. Yeah. It's got about 38% of Earth's gravity. So the expectation is the impact on our bodies isn't going to be anywhere near as bad as being in open spaces.
Mm. So on Mars itself, and I don't know how much of this is discussed... And no doubt you've touched on a lot of this stuff already, but what sort of expectations have been set as far as... Obviously, there's a goal of why it's happening and the mission to go there. But you're going to narrow it down to these final people that go. What's the expectations of what are these people going to achieve?
Survive.
Just
like literally survive. So especially for the first four, it is stay alive.
Yep.
Staying alive means maintain a life support system, keep growing plants, look after the toilet system, like maintain all these systems. I'll use a military term. They really are the beachhead. They're the ones who land on the beach, they hold the ground, and the people who come along behind it, they make it easier for the people who come along behind it.
Have they got a plan? No doubt they've got a plan. I'm oversimplifying it. No, they haven't thought of this. But that duration of time between that first group landing and that second group coming in, is that
that's entirely aligned with the planets. Yep. So that every 26 months, there is a 1 month window through 2.5-3 week window that you can launch things to Mars on a fast transit and get them there in between 6 and 8 months. And that only happens every 26 months. So when the first crew go, they'll be going with their habitat to stay alive on the way there. There'll already be a habitat on Mars waiting for them, but they'll go over in their system, land. At the same time, they'll be launching all the supplies for the second crew in the same window. So a couple of weeks after the first crew arrive, all the equipment, all the habitats, all the bits and pieces that you need for the second group are landing afterwards as well. And so the first crew, once they've settled in, then go to work building the habitat for the second group of people, which will launch 26 months later with all the equipment for the third group. So it's this stepwise.
So that first group, exciting, but...
brutal.
But it sucks to be them in a way, because that's going to be really tough.
It's 7 months for them to get there, and then you're looking at, it's 26 months before the next window opens. So it's four of you for those bit over 2 years, and you self-reliant. Something goes wrong, you're relying on the three other people you're there with.
You got to MacGyver it. You just got to work it out.
So MacGyver's the perfect example. I do corporate talks quite a bit, and people I say, who would you send to Mars? and it's always Homer Simpson and MacGyver. Homer is an adventurous couch potato, yeah. So he goes off and does crazy stuff and then quite happily sits in front of the TV and yeah. does very little, which yeah. is kind of what we need. Mm. You also need MacGyver types who, if something goes wrong, they'll find a solution. Mm. They will use what's available and they'll put it together in a weird and wonderful way to solve a problem, rather than trying to have a textbook that goes, this is the way that you need to fix this thing. They'll just look at the problem, look at the resources and fix it.
And I'm sure there'd be a million things that are on this first group's mind, but procreating is not going to be on the agenda, and I would assume, to begin with anyway, and I would assume that it'd probably be extremely dangerous and troublesome if anything should happen when it comes to this type of stuff. But I would assume that at some stage, whether it be the fourth, fifth, sixth group or whatever, that those types of things would be considered as far as continuing.
So yeah, for the colony to be self-sustaining, mm. you are going to eventually have people die. You need to replace those people, mm. and you can't necessarily rely on more people being delivered from Earth. Mm. So yeah, they'll be babies on Mars eventually. Mm. The biggest critical, and I do talk about this in the book, the biggest thing is human medical trials. Mm. You usually need 10 to 15 years of animal data mm. before you start human trials on things, and especially when it comes to procreation. Mm. We don't know how an embryo will form in one third of Earth's gravity. And what we have seen from rats trying to breed on the International Space Station, embryos don't form properly in zero G. Is 38% Earth gravity enough to have an embryo form properly? Will that embryo be deformed? Mm. Like all of these questions. Wow. So that's the big focus for us, is not to rush to go having babies. I can't think of anything worse than like a three-year-old running around inside something that's equivalent to a nuclear submarine. But that data will be collected. Mm. And if you can start to see very clear trends of this is what you can expect from a child, well then the first mother on Mars is going to be taking a hell of a risk. Mm. But someone is sure to do it. Someone will do it. It doesn't mean there's a barrier to relationships, but in terms of actually having kids, we'll have the capacity to end a pregnancy rather than to bring it all the way to term.
Well, I mean, the whole thing itself is risk.
Yeah.
You know, so I think by the time you get to those stages where those types of scenarios are being discussed and things have to take place, that people are already well past any sort of...
It's interesting seeing how people's comfort zones get pushed. Mm. I have done things since I got involved with this that I never expected. If you'd asked me 10 years ago, there's absolutely no way that I would have been living the way that I happily do now. Mm. That said, kids is a funny one. It's a central sort of a very instinctual thing for people. Mm. And whether or not someone would take the risk in order to have a child on Mars just for the sake of having a kid, mm. whether or not you would find people who would go to Mars willing to take that risk, it's not for me, and I wouldn't ever try and... I will never be able to understand where someone would be coming from in that position. So I'm not even going to comment.
No, I mean, there's enough sensitivity here on planet Earth with a lot of these types of things, and you know, even in the name of science as well, there's yep. so much debate. And so for something that's so out of this world...
It's a deeply personal thing.
Absolutely.
I won't go into too many details, but I had a relationship a few years ago who I loved her a lot. Mm. We loved each other a lot. Mm. But we recognised fairly early on, I had zero interest in having kids mm. because signing up for a one-way mission to Mars,
yep.
she had always wanted to be a mum. Mm. And we, even though compatible on every other level, this core thing at the base, we ended up turning around and saying, hey, I turned around to her and said, I want you to go and find the guy that will be the father to your children. Mm. And I'm really... I still stay in touch with her. We're still quite close. And I'm really, really pleased that she has met that guy and she's going to have a baby very soon. Mm. But there was no budging on my perspective and there was no budging on her perspective. And so I think people know when it comes to procreating, when it comes to that sort of stuff, they know what their, where their heart sits, where their instincts lie, and there's not a lot of budge on that.
And I think going back to what you said before, as far as some of those final stages of when you're shortlisting the group to try and work out who's going to be in these final groups that are actually going to travel, you know, doing all these bonding exercises, yep, to work out psychologically how people interact with each other, because we're such complex beings, there's going to be a lot of variables and a lot of unknowns that aren't going to be tackled until they happen, in a way, like once you're out there and sort of going through.
Well, the hope is, at least with the training is long enough that getting people to show who they are. I've had a bit of experience with this now with especially the corporate teamwork side of things. You can create scenarios where people show their true colors,
yep,
very quickly.
Yep.
Like there's one exercise that I do that sounds, when I describe it, super basic, very, you know, very generic. You change a couple of things with that exercise and 30 seconds. Like you are seeing who the psychopaths are, you're seeing who the sulks are, you're seeing all of these things just by changing a couple. So it's not, if you know what to look for, it's not hard to push people's buttons and to see the true selves. And we have a huge amount of time available to put people together in different arrangements to see personality traits start to emerge. When you start putting people in habitats, that amplifies everything up again. Like you wake up in the morning and you see the same stupid three faces every single day, you're going to figure out in a very short period of time which of those three faces you can tolerate and which ones you can't. And you amplify the pressure even further by putting people in a mock habitat and don't tell them how long they're going to be in there for.
People can barely, you know, hold on to a marriage these days, let alone something, you know, or just any type of relationship.
So there's that. But also, because we're in an open society, you're not locked in.
So you know there's an alternative.
But you know, and you, if you've got a problem, if you're having issues, if I've had some terrible relationships in my time, and one way of diluting or avoiding the issue is to throw yourself into something else. Now, if there is nothing else, if you are in that habitat and all the four of you are doing is keeping things running, and you have some massive personality conflict with someone, you can't avoid it. And that's why these things come out super quickly. A matter of weeks, and it becomes super clear, we were never going to put Steve and Jacqueline in the same habitat ever, ever again. Even though they might get along fantastically outside of it, put them in a high pressure pot, not a chance. So it does not take long to identify those kind of personality conflicts.
Oh, it's a bit of fly on the wall. It's like
you get to watch it. It's all being broadcast. That's the whole thing. Like
I love it. It's fantastic. It's like Big Brother, but it's actually real. You know,
Well, so we had Paul Romer, who was the guy who first produced Big Brother in the Netherlands. He was originally an advisor for us. We have never wanted Big Brother in space. We've wanted a documentary series that follows the first people living on another planet. But that idea of Big Brother in space and being able to see real reality TV, not just like reality TV, inverted commas type, but actual follow these people along, don't be invasive. There is enough drama involved with what we're doing already without fabricating it.
Yeah.
So just follow along and see these different personalities emerge over time.
Well, got a lot of watching to do. Far out. A bunch of lab rats. And I say that in the nicest way possible,
of course.
But it's exciting. As I said before, everything's going to be in the show notes so people can check you out, check out the book as well.
Yep.
Follow you and keep up to date with what's happening.
My usual mischief.
Absolutely. I tell you what, credit to you for having a handle, mighty_Ginge.
Ginge, yeah.
Just like, well done.
It's 10 years, that handle's 10 years old now, and I'm still incredibly proud of it.
There you go, it sticks. Well done. And good luck tonight with Denton.
Thank you. This has been a lot of fun, and I'm sure tonight's going to be fun as well. So.
Can't wait. Awesome. Thank you.
Cheers.
We're shaking hands.
Yes.
To learn more about Josh, you can go to joshrichards.space. You can also follow him on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, as well as subscribing to his YouTube channel. You can click through to the show notes via your podcast player or go over to andysocial.net, and there'll be a whole bunch of clickable links to everything that we discussed in this chat, including his book, Becoming Martian. Highly recommended. You can grab the audio version, the Kindle/PDF version, or you can grab a physical copy as well. Go over there, joshrichards.space. All the details are there, or andysocial.net. A few updates before we wrap it up. No release date. Still don't have a release date. Fucking hell. Jesus Christ. Oh, fuck. Anybody that's been listening to this podcast for the past several months will hear me have this wide-ranging roller coaster sort of tsunami of emotions that have been going up and down as I sort of tease information and say, oh, it's coming soon. Get ready. I can't wait to share more information. And then, like, the next week I have this like emotional breakdown, and I think that it's all gonna sort of just die in its ass. And I think this week is gonna be an example of me sort of having a borderline mental breakdown. We are getting so close to releasing this album. We are waiting to finalize a Japanese deal, and fuck me, this is like I'm about to neck myself. It's just crazy. So we're really excited. Can't wait to get this album out. If you've never listened to this podcast before, apologies, I'm usually a little bit more together with these updates, but we are really getting pushed to our limits at the moment. So it will be worth the wait, probably, I would hope. The album's fantastic. We can't wait to share it with everybody. It will be something that will tick the boxes with everybody that has loved the band to date. It covers everything from old school dungeon to newer stuff that we've been doing. It's a great album. Very biased, I know, but I'm looking forward to sharing it with everybody. So we'll have news soon. But in the meantime, we're going out on tour at the end of June, and maybe we might, anyway, there's going to be things that are going to happen around these shows, but we go out on tour starting on the 21st of June at the Basement in Canberra, the 28th of June at the Back Room in Brisbane, the 29th of June at the Badlands Bar in Perth. It's part of the Stormrider Festival there. The 5th of July at the Evelyn Hotel in Melbourne, which is part of the Forge Heavy Metal Nightclub. The 6th of July at Jive Nightclub in Adelaide, and the 26th of July at Crowbar in Sydney, which is part of the first ever Forge Heavy Metal Nightclub in Sydney. So Sydney folks, you know how shit the scene is there, especially when it comes to metal, and local metal and things like that. Crowbar have been doing fantastic things in 2019 with sort of rejuvenating the local scene, crossing a whole range of different genres. And I think for metal fans, opportunities like this, where there is potentially going to be a reoccurring metal nightclub every month or every couple of months or whatever it is, whatever it's going to be, it's a great opportunity to get out and support something like that. And Sydney needs as much support as possible. So get out there and support the venues that do support music so we can continue to build off that and not sit back and complain, because we love to do that. And also, folks, a little bit of a call to action, get your tickets in advance for all these shows. It's a massive help to us, of course, but more importantly, it's a massive help to the local promoters and the venues. It validates them to put on more metal shows and just, you know, heavy music shows. And we need to be doing whatever we can. So I know lots of people like to make a decision on the night, leave it to the last minute, buy a ticket at the door, because then, you know, a lot of these shows never sell out. Just buy a ticket in advance. It's just a massive, massive help. It will spread yourself out financially, so you don't have to worry about extra costs on the night. You can just rock up, feel like your name's on the door, and you'll have extra money on the night to be able to buy a beer or maybe a CD, maybe a brand new Lord CD. That would be a crazy concept, or a t-shirt or something else. So it's a massive help. It's something that if you've got a spare few dollars, go and get the tickets in advance. It's just a huge way to support and with very minimal sort of input. So, or commitment, I should say. Well, you're probably committing to, anyway, enough rambling on. Selfsider. So season 2 is out. Gosh, I'm so sorry. Season 2 is out now. The first episode of season two is with Chris Pachenko of Speed Metal Scrap and of Vanishing Point fame. Go and check that out. If you've loved season one of the podcast, I reckon you'll enjoy season two as well. Please share it around if you know anybody that is trying to get their own business up and running, or they're an ideas person but they never take action, or somebody that's out there doing their own thing. Please get out there and support the podcast, but share these conversations around with people as well. I'm just watching somebody... Oh, I got distracted. I'm sitting in a national park recording this outro, and I was watching someone moving in the bushes. Sounds sus. Anyway, it's all good. Fine. I'm so distracted this morning. I'm recording this like really early in the morning at a national park. So, anyway, head somewhere else. So yeah, please support it. Please share these episodes around. If you know anybody that ticks any boxes that might get a dose of inspiration from these stories, I've tried to make the stories and the backgrounds and the locations of people quite varied. They are all across Australia. It's both metropolitan and regional. And then, you know, depending on how season two goes, I'll go into season three and then probably extend outside of Australia as well. But for me, Australia's a big thing. There's a lot of people that think that there's a lack of opportunities out there, and I just think that there's a lot that we can do with our own skills and our own will and efforts. So Self-Start is a great example to show people what the possibilities are. So I hope that these stories inspire people. So go and check it all out, selfstarter.com.au, and support season two because it is out now. Okay, a couple of last things. You can search for me on YouTube. I know some of you, not many of you, but some of you listen to the podcast on YouTube. But if you want to search for my name on YouTube, you'll find my YouTube channel. It's got all the Antisocial episodes out to date. And I have just put out a video series about how to start a podcast. It's a little bit of a different thing for me. I haven't really done anything like this before. And Tim from our band has done a fantastic job in helping me see... make this a reality. And it's an 11-part series. Each video is about 2 minutes each, so really sort of bite-sized chunks of information. It's basic as fuck, but it's a really good starting point for anybody that's been thinking about the idea of starting a podcast. So like just, you know, anybody that's sort of going, maybe I kind of like the idea of doing that. Maybe I've got an idea that I could sort of follow through with. Have a look at these videos. They might sort of at least get you thinking a little bit more and give you a bit more clarity as far as what you need to think about and what you need to do. And I'm more than happy to help people. So if you do have an idea or you've got any questions about starting your podcast, let me know. But those videos are out now. It was a massive challenge for me to push through and actually follow through with this idea, and I've done it. So I'm very happy. So I'm giving myself a little pat on the back there. So if you know anybody that might be interested, please share these videos around. There's a playlist that's been created as well, so you can just share the playlist link also. I'm really happy with, I'm happy with what it is and what it's come out as, given that this is the first time I've ever done it. So there's awkward moments, but there's a fair bit of humor in there, and I've tried to take the piss as much as I can. So hopefully people will enjoy it, but go and check all that out. Also, there in the description links of those videos is a little link to join my mailing list. And I've created a PDF that's about, 20 pages long. And in that PDF, there's all of the notes in greater detail from the podcast video series. And there's also some additional stuff in there. So if you haven't checked out things such as Self-Starter or the band, or I've got some highlights from the Antisocial podcast. So if you're listening to the podcast for the first time now, fucking well done. If you're still listening to me crap on in this episode, you will get a link to a PDF when you sign up for my mailing list. And there's heaps of stuff in there. So I hope you enjoy that. And monthly emails will be sent out via the mailing list. So there'll be little highlights from the month that was for all the podcasts and the band. There'll be some updates, some exclusive information. I'm going to start accumulating extra free stuff and do giveaways and little shout outs and things like that along the way. I want to make it as interactive as I can over time. And I'll certainly appreciate any input that anybody has as far as making these little monthly mail outs as exciting as possible, because I know that a lot of people get a lot of junk sent to them in email formats. So I'm hoping that I can cut through the noise and create something that's interesting to read. So we'll see what happens. But that's all happening. It's almost done. The first email mail out, but you can sign up to the mailing list right now by clicking on the description links. But also if you go to andydowling.net or andysocial.net, there'll be a little pop-up window where you can sign up to the mailing list there as well. And I believe, this train of thought just coming in as I'm talking, You can also use the mailing list link or tab on the Andy Dowling or Andy Social Facebook page as well. There's a little tab there that you can sign up to the mailing list also. So there's heaps of opportunities and ways to sign up. Please sign up if you can. If you think it's shit after a while, then you can unsubscribe at any time. But give me a chance, please. I'm looking forward to sharing some new types of content with you guys and making an exclusive little group of people that I can share some things with. So we'll see what happens there. Anyway, fucking hell, I've got to get on with my day. So enough crapping on from me. Lots and lots of episodes coming. I've had some great conversations. I think I've recorded about 7 weeks in advance and I am still recording more and more. At the time of this recording coming out, I'm about to go to Japan, I think, or is that the week after? Anyway, I'm going to Japan soon. Don't know if I'll do a podcast there, but we'll see how we go. Anyway, enough of me. Thank you very much, and until next week, folks, ta-ta. Larry. Larry, please.